Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Mark Gaberti, and this is the podcast for entrepreneurs who are looking for the breakthrough for their businesses. In life, we're going to come across some really big questions, some questions that are really deep, and the answers that we formulate for those questions are really going to impact the way we view life and what we're able to accomplish. So when we do come across a big question, we have to come up with an answer that essentially shapes a part of our life philosophy. And that's something we're going to discuss in this episode. So today's guests, yes, this is another episode where we have two guests. So today's guests co-founded the Art Commission Marketplace, ArtCorgi.com, and TravelMax, a travel company that offers white glove concierge travel services without any fees. And they run a travel company splitting their time between North American headquarters in Miami, Florida, and South American offices in Lima, Peru. Together, they recently published their book, The Pragmatist Guide to Life, which will help you formulate your own answers to life's biggest questions. Today's guest, all right, I'll just redo that last part. Today's guests for episode 143 of the Breakthrough Success Podcast are none other than Simone and Malcolm Collins. Simone and Malcolm, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show.
We are so thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for inviting us.
It is a pleasure to have the two of you on the show, and we do get these big questions in life. We do have to answer them, but I feel like it's something that we don't really think about until we have that question in front of us. And your book, The Pragmatist Guide to Life, offers a really good approach to answering those questions. But I'd love to get some backstory. So why did the two of you write that book together?
Well, one of the first things that Malcolm foisted upon me, I was a very unwilling subject here, was those big questions in life. We actually started dating, let's see, well, maybe 7 years ago now. And one of the first things when we were dating really early on, he started asking me was, why do you choose to exist? What do you, you know, what is going to be the point of your life? And I didn't really have any good answers.
Well, you did have answers. You were like, well, you know, generic, you know, like help people and stuff like that. You know, you're like, I am living a successful, well-balanced life based on sort of the tropes and self-image that was given to her growing up. You know, she was like, I run a semi-successful YouTube channel. I work at I'm director of marketing at the 45th highest trafficked, you know, website in the U.S. I run a team of 20,000 people. Like, she had achieved, you know, a level of success that made her feel was in the way success had been defined for her growing up, that she had what she wanted from life.
Yeah, I had grown up checking all the boxes and feeling that I was someone who thought critically and was a high achiever and a thinker, and Malcolm really helped me understand that actually most of us don't ever really, really ask what we want to do with our lives and carefully make our own answers. I think the problem is that most of us get exposed to that question, what's the purpose of life? Or, you know, what do I value? And then we're given immediately the answer. Well, of course you value the environment. Of course you value human welfare. Of course you want to be happy. And then you just choose one of those stock answers or all of them. And that may not actually be what, if you actually stopped to ask yourself these hard questions, you decide.
And the fire necessary to really push through with entrepreneurship or anything like that often comes from conviction that you know that what you're doing actually matters and will actually matter to you. And that conviction is something that it's very hard to draw from if you're just trying to generically fulfill a role within life. You know, a role of a successful people or a role of a, you know, a social media star or something like that. It's really hard to draw upon, you know, the conviction you need to pull those late nights and deal with the failure that's inevitably going to come your way.
Precisely. This is what separates Elon Musk from the thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley who never did execute on a vision that became anything.
Who are executing on being entrepreneurs because they want to be entrepreneurs, because they, you know, the entrepreneur stereotype.
Yeah.
That is their end goal. Be a successful entrepreneur. And you're like, well, why? So I have money. Well, what do you want the money for? So I make other people happy. Well, is there a more efficient way to make other people happy at a larger scale in the meantime? You know, it's anyway, continue.
It's interesting how you go deeper into the why, and I feel like you can learn a lot about yourself. You keep asking why. I mean, people aren't really like trying to grow their businesses for the money. They're trying to do it for what the money gives them, which is something that the two of you were hinting at in your answer. And one of the things I would like to know, I was very interested, Simone, when I saw that you were you helped HubPages as the director of marketing. And the reason I want to bring this up is because I got my start through Squidoo, which was really big for me. So I've got like over 150 of them. Now they're all moved on to HubPages now. But so like I saw it, I was like, wow. So I know that we're going to be talking about the focus on answering these big questions. But I'm wondering if you could talk about how you were able to grow HubPages as the director of marketing.
A lot of it came down to telling people and showing people the difference between writing content that they wanted to write or that they thought was interesting and writing content that people actually want to read and that people are searching for and content that will get traffic. And I'm sure as you know very well, Mark, it's like this is a core principle of entrepreneurship as well, right? I mean, entrepreneurs often find themselves falling into the trap of creating a product that nobody needs and instead of looking for people's needs. And that was really the core principle that we just tried to teach to the community and tried to communicate beyond. You have to look at people's needs if you want to actually have a product they want.
And this is a really interesting concept, I think. The idea that people will create something that maybe even people need.
But they don't want.
But they don't want.
Yeah.
There's many things that people need, especially when it comes to self-help related stuff or making your business successful, that people just don't want.
Oh, and we were so frustrated. So, I mean, as, you know, HubPage's staff, we'd come across these brilliant articles, you know, like how to organize your personal finances, you know, wonderfully illustrated, extremely well annotated. And yet, you know, when I even go back to my articles that I still have up there that make the most money, it's stuff like literally, quote unquote, how to kiss a boy well. And it, because that's just what people are searching for. No one cares about getting their finances in order. That's tedious.
So the interesting thing here is even if you have a specific message you want to share with the world, it might actually be a better path to reach that goal to write your articles that make you the money, you know, or write your books, you know, your short erotic novels that actually bring in the income, and then use that income to promote the material that you know the world needs but doesn't want.
Right.
Instead of trying to make an income with the material that you know the world needs and doesn't want. And that's very much what was sort of our perspective with our book, is that, you know, it's owned by a not-for-profit and we use the money that we make with our other companies to promote it because we know that it's
no 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah. And really thinking through your purposes in life and where you want to be in the world.
It's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable. It's not something that people
flies off bookshelves.
Flies off bookshelves. I mean, it is a bestseller right now on Amazon, but it's probably because of our promotion.
Yeah.
It's interesting how you say that you bring in the income one way and you use that income to promote something that you may want to spread because you know that people need this, but they may not necessarily want it. That is another perspective on how to grow your audience and just spread a message that you believe is very important. So I do find that really interesting. And the book's core concept is being able to formulate those answers to some of life's biggest questions. I know that you guys don't like giving the answers, like you want us to formulate on our own, but I'm wondering if you could share with us how we can formulate some of the answers to life's biggest questions.
I think that so one of the core things of the book is we want this book to be something that is applicable to anyone, you know, regardless of your religious or philosophical background coming into this. It's not just about coming up with your own answers to life's biggest questions. I mean, that's what we use on the title of the book, but the book is really four stages. One is decide what your objective function is. Your objective function is what you're sort of trying to maximize with your life. It can be a collection of things. It can be a single thing. It could be anything from, serving God's will to maximizing your own happiness, to a combination, like maximizing your own happiness as long as it doesn't interfere, like a more complicated equation with the happiness of other people. And really drilling down onto what exactly your objective function is the first part of the book. But then we look at things like, well, how then do you come up with a hypothesis for how you can see that objective function realized in the world? And then the third section is, how do you change yourself into the type of person who could best maximize your objective function? And the fourth is, how do you control how other people see you so other people are seeing you in a way that best helps you maximize your objective function?
But Mark, also to more pointedly answer your question, formulating your own answers to those questions, as far as we were concerned with writing the book, a lot of it comes down to knowing what your options are. And so what we tried to do is outline a lot of answers that people might come to, as well as like, okay, and here are reasons why maybe those aren't the right answers, so that people just know what their options are. We also try to parse out in the book some of the underpinnings that lead people to different answers. Like, for example, you should be considering what we call your standard of evidence before making a call on what an answer is or deciding what will help you make that call. Is a good standard of evidence what you experience personally, what you read in the New York Times, what a bunch of scientific studies have found to be their new theory or consensus on something, or what you found from a religious experience, a vision.
And the way that we help people think through these things is, for example, what she just said, we'd say, okay, whether you believe or don't believe in ghosts, what specific evidence would you need to change your belief on that topic? If you saw a ghost, you know, personal experience, would you be more likely to think, you know, I'm probably crazy because I'm seeing that ghost? That seeing a ghost, believing that I saw a ghost, would not change my belief in ghosts. Or if the New York Times came out and said ghosts are real, would that change your belief in ghosts? And we try to help people do this for sort of questions for them that are big, like, okay, I have X stance on gun control. Well, what evidence would you need and what categories of evidence would you need to change your view on that subject? If you're talking specifically about how the book might help someone like you specifically to think through what they believe, you put a very, you're sort of very telling on your website. You're clear about what you want to achieve with your life. Like, your objective function appears to be, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, to maximize the number of people that you are able to reach with a message that helps them.
Yeah.
Is that sort of correct?
Yes.
So what the book would do in this context is you'd read through it and you realize there's actually a number of different sort of philosophical underpinnings that could lead you to that objective function. For example, you may believe that is your objective function because you believe that increasing the aggregate happiness of the world is of intrinsic value, or the aggregate sort of positive emotional state of the world. And you believe then your sort of ideology, your hypothesis on how to maximize that is by reaching the most people. Or you could believe that you are the ideas in your head. And your goal is sort of the ideas and memes that make up your consciousness is to spread those ideas as much as possible.
Because it's basically your best bet at immortality.
Right. Well, there's two reasons to do it. One is it's because your best bet at immortality. And two is it's because you think you literally are the memes and the memes' goal is to spread and then the immortality isn't important there.
Ah, yes.
But so it would help you sort of think through the different things that could motivate an objective function like that.
I've been thinking about that right now, and you definitely gave me more reasons to continue to do what I do and also to do it on a bigger scale. And I feel like it's very important for us to establish all these different reasons for taking action and moving towards this ideal version of ourselves. And I'm wondering if there are any other ways that we can make that change where we are that ideal self, or we are moving in the path that we want to move. I mean, giving yourself reasons to take action is an incredible start, but what else do you think we can do?
Well, that's what Malcolm was talking about a little bit earlier, which is, okay, now you know what you want to do with your life, and you need to create the perfect tool to execute on that action, and that's you. So he starts with your basically perception of yourself, and what ideal self would you be if you want to achieve this end? And then you figure out, okay, well, how do we sort of carve ourselves into that or shape ourselves more into that? And then the second part is, how do you shape the way the public sees you in a way that is conducive to having them, you know, accept what your objective function is? I mean, if your goal is to be, you know, to make as many people as happy as possible, you're probably going to be a more pleasant, agreeable person. You'll probably want to smell decent. I mean,
from your perspective, I mean, if you're looking at that final section, there's actually a lot of sort of cognitive tricks that you can implement to be shared more online, to be have a higher amount of mental scape in your viewers and in people who interact with your content.
Right, like how to get people to remember you more, how to get people to want to subscribe to your show, read your content, whatever it may be. I think content creators would find this section of the book to be quite interesting because it includes a tool set of basically how to get people interested in whatever content you have.
So, for example, one of the things we talk a lot about in that section that would be directly relevant to sort of your goals is that people like to interact with mentally simple caricatures of individuals who they sort of wished existed in the world. And you can see some politicians who have done this really well. I think three that come to mind would be Trump did this really well, Sarah Palin did this really well, and Bill Clinton did this really well. Ted Kennedy also did this really well. Where they create this sort of image of a person that just fits so snugly in your mind. Sarah Palin probably did this the best, where you're like, oh, that makes sense to me. That's like a thing that fits my worldview. And these don't necessarily need to be positive images to hold a large mental scape in someone's brain. You know, a way I would talk about this is if you met somebody who is like a Professor Umbridge, is her name?
Yeah.
Professor Umbridge from the Harry Potter series. If you had a professor like that at any point in your educational career, she would hold like 20% of all of your memories of teachers. That would be the main teacher that you remembered and would be your archetype of a teacher because she fits this model in this simple stereotype of someone we want to exist so well. When I say want, I don't necessarily mean want, but this sort of fits a worldview.
Well, we like it when people make sense and when we feel we can predict them and when we feel we can model them. And if you present something that's predictable and modelable.
Yeah, a lot of times people try to be too nuanced in the person they try to portray to the world. It's like they want to be a video game and they think the best way to advertise that video game is to put the video game's code on the box. You know, advertise everything about the video game in nuanced little code. And if you did that, all video game boxes would basically look the same.
Yeah, but what we really want to see is like
highlights.
Yeah, or like the Assassin's Creed guy looking epic standing on top of a building. That does not describe what happens in the games, but
right. But it highlights maybe how the game is like some other games and different from other games.
Yeah,
you know, and it's the same with when you're advertising yourself in public. What you're advertising is what differentiates you from other people in society and what makes you fit an easy, simple role in people's brains.
Hmm.
Thank you for sharing those great insights. And one of the things that like I've noticed when people are pursuing a big goal is that sometimes they feel like they're not fully able to achieve that goal. I feel like different things are holding them back. And I'm wondering what the two of you thought about what you two believe holds most people back from reaching their full potential.
I would say it's an external locus of control, which is described as blaming other things, be they legitimate or not, on your failures instead of yourself. Because in the end, the only thing you can control is yourself. I mean, you may have been born unlucky or you may end up being unlucky in life, but the only thing you can ever do about it is take action yourself.
I would say, again, in the book we describe a good way to tell if you have an external locus of control is think back on the last five major failures in your life and then ask yourself how many of those were your fault and how many of those were society's or somebody else's fault. If two of them are somebody else's fault, especially if more of them are somebody else's fault, it's likely you have an external locus of control.
Oh, hell, I'd say if any of them are somebody else's fault, but I'm really intolerant about that kind of thing. Still, I mean, when we look at people, that's what we come to see.
And society is really beginning to indulge this
work. Yeah, no, it's because I had a traumatic event in my childhood. It's because my metabolism isn't right. It's because, you know, society's biased against me. And that is, we feel, a fairly toxic view to have because it encourages you to just wait for someone to save you. And nobody's going to save you.
Basically, you need to delude yourself into believing everything's your fault. Even if it's not your fault, you're going to do much better if you accept an internal locus of control. And we're not saying this from just a generic viewpoint. There's lots and lots of studies on this.
Yes.
And the studies all show that people with internal locuses of control are, you know, more happy and more successful. And basically, once you get over a certain threshold of an external locus of control, you cannot move above a certain level.
You become helpless.
Yeah.
I mean, the blame game is something that, like, people are more tempted to do because in some cases it can keep them from something bad happening to them. But we do have to take responsibility. I feel like this is something that everyone knows that we should not be blaming people, but instead we should be taking responsibility. But I understand the toxic environment that creates when you blame others in society instead of looking inward, but how are you two able to look inward and say, and just raise the hand and say, like, this is my fault, instead of like trying to find something else to pin the blame to?
This plays a big role in the section before that final section about your public self in the book that we talk about, which is changing the way that you view yourself. And a lot of it comes down to just very carefully deciding who you are and who you are not. And if you design yourself and believe yourself to be someone who always takes responsibility, and you come to see yourself as, you know, I, Mark, take personal responsibility no matter what, you'll start to do it. So, I'm still going to say it's human instinct to try to blame someone else. But if you have that internal identity of someone who does take personal responsibility, you catch yourself. So if I like trip over something in the bathroom and I stub my toe and it really hurts, my immediate instinct is, Malcolm, how could you put that there? It's all your, no. And then I catch myself and I'm like, I was clumsy. I wasn't looking where I was going. I should have turned the light on. I think it comes to that section is designing your internal self in a way that will affect the way that you emotionally react to things. And it gets really complicated and technical in the book. I don't think we have time to go into it, but the way you come to view yourself, per Malcolm's theory.
I used to be a neuroscientist, a published neuroscientist, still exhibit on display at the Smithsonian. So I have some experience in the space.
Right. And per his understanding of the way that a lot of basically reactions happen after basic processing takes place in our minds.
Essentially, we check a story we tell ourselves about what's happening in our environment, the environmental stimuli that we're experiencing. We create a story about that, and then we check that story against an internal self-image, which is very similar to the theories of mind we create when modeling other people. So the internal image we have from ourselves is probably kind of running off of the same software as the images we create when we make up someone in our mind that we're having an argument with.
So Malcolm stubs his toe, he's thinking, well, what would Malcolm react to?
Yeah, how would Malcolm react to this situation?
Yes.
And the key to changing these impulses to think in certain ways is learning how to change this model you have of yourself within your brain that determines the emotional states your brain decides to output. And that's something some of them can be very hard. Like when we talk about an internal versus external locus of control, it's often easy to sort of overlook how seductive an external locus of control is, because it means that your failures aren't your fault. And in reality, you're pretty successful given the drawbacks you've had in your life. And, you know, you get to feel good about yourself even if you haven't done things that should allow you to feel good about yourself.
Yeah.
Or when I say should, I mean, I guess you can change. I mean, one thing the book would say is that's just my perception. You could think, well, I care most about feeling good about myself. Therefore, I'm going to design an internal self-image that maximizes the amount of time I'm able to feel good about myself and self-righteous. In which case, you would design a self-image that has an external locus of control. However, such a self-image would never make you capable of any terms of real success in terms of the way society views success, which is what you were asking about.
It's definitely something very important. And I love that idea of thinking of how you would react to the situation. And with that thinking, like before the situation happens, it's easier to formulate these better responses and thinking patterns where you are putting the responsibility on yourself instead of blaming, which is something that can happen a lot as we go through some of the challenges in life. And I'm wondering if the two of you could share a big challenge that you faced in your journey and a powerful lesson you learned during that challenge.
Oh my God, which challenge?
Well, I mean, an interesting thing is I don't even know if we really see them as challenges. I mean, we created a plan to optimize for a certain outcome. Sometimes the plan didn't entirely work out, but whenever we were trying a specific path, we always had backup paths. We always knew what we were going to do if this failed, and what we were going to do if this backup path failed, and what we were going to do if this backup path failed.
Yeah, sort of like, it appears that we've reached turning point B. Now that means we haven't met threshold W, so we need to go to plan Q.
Right, and this is something that anyone can sort of draw out for their future. And sort of see...
But people like narratives.
People do like narratives. Well, so then you work a narrative back.
No. What I'm saying is we should tell a narrative of something that happened in our lives. We did that.
Okay, we'll choose one. What's a good narrative?
God, you know, I guess so we just closed on, we didn't actually co-found Travel Max. We acquired it. And we acquired it from a group of investors that is accustomed to very different types of deals. And we had a really big challenge raising the capital to acquire the company because they were just like not used to companies like this. This is an international company. They usually just invest in American companies. This was in an industry that a lot of people think to be scary, the travel industry, which we actually found to be fascinating in terms of the opportunities. So that was a big challenge. How did we overcome it? I mean, a lot of it just came down to grit in the end. And when we found that in this industry, we raised money from investors to buy a single company, not knowing what company we were going to buy. A lot of other people are doing this right now. It's called entrepreneurship through acquisition, and it's a really interesting model. I think the big lesson we learned from that is everyone is facing this huge challenge of how do I find a company I can buy? And also, how do, once I find that company, I convince my investors to give me the money to buy it? That's a huge challenge. A lot of people don't pass it. More and more people are not ultimately closing on deals at all who pursue this particular path. And what got us through in that case, and I think what gets through or most entrepreneurs through any situation, is grit. In this particular case, we decided not to give up and we closed.
But you say grit, but grit just means, you know, you got to just keep working all day, put everything on the line for it, but within a way where you still have a backup plan.
Yeah.
So a lot of people here put everything on the line for something and they think that means, you know, risk everything, put all their personal capital on the line or something like that. And that is not what that means.
No.
That means you consider, okay, so we're trying to close on this deal, but by showing how hard we're working on this deal and by showing how much we're willing to sacrifice to get it closed, we're endearing ourselves to this investor group, which could be of utility if this deal doesn't close to this other type of deal. You know, you're so yeah, everything on the line, but everything on a line in a way that gives you backup options.
Yeah, know your boundaries and know your backup plans, but also don't give up on whatever it is your ultimate goal may be.
Well, no, that's a bad one. Don't give up. That's stupid, because then people just keep doing
things. No, our objective functions would be
fail. But you've got to know when any particular path in the branching tree has failed.
Yes, absolutely.
And a lot of people don't recognize when they need to triage a specific path.
No, no, no. I'm all for cutting your losses. What I mean by don't give up is don't give up on whatever enduring objective function you have.
Oh, yes. Obviously, don't give up on your objective function. But I think a lot of people – so, for example, somebody might say, well, I want to reach as many people as possible, right?
Yes.
And I'm not sure if my show is getting enough traction or whatever – then they could reach a fork in the path where they say, well, you know, I've learned a lot about certain types of marketing with this, and I bet by implementing them, I could make a significant amount of money by starting X type of local company and then selling it. And I could then leverage that money to have a big platform.
The ads that I need to promote the show or whatever.
Right. And so then the question becomes, okay, when do I give up this strategy for achieving my objective function for this other strategy? And a lot of people hear never give up, and what they hear is never give up a particular thesis of how you're going to achieve your objective function. Hmm. And we gave up on a lot of theses along the way. I mean, we used to be in venture capital, and we thought that that was going to be our path, and we realized that that was not an effective route for us.
Yeah, that's true.
It's interesting how you have the backup plan in place, and some people have this idea of going all in, and it's good to go all in based on, like, you commit a lot of time to this, but you do need to have that backup plan, as you mentioned, which so you have something to rely on in case things don't go the way they're supposed to go. I mean, it's always good to anticipate setbacks, hope that they don't happen, but do definitely anticipate for them so that you're more prepared when something does come up. And we've spent a lot of time talking about your book, The Pragmatist Guide to Life, which is available on Amazon. But I'm wondering if the two of you could recommend three great books that you believe would have a positive impact on us.
Malcolm, do you have any favorites? He's not a huge reader.
No, I don't.
A huge impact. I'm going to say Accelerando. Because I think sometimes you need to read good science fiction to get out of whatever bubble you're in and start thinking in terms of long-term different ways of living and different ways of solving problems and just reading something really weird. Books that in terms of productivity really help.
I mean, you used to like self-help books, but in general, they're not that useful. They just repeat the same thing a bunch.
They do. Okay, another one that's really good is The Nudge Unit, if you want to have influence over other people. This book is called Inside the Nudge Unit, and it's a really interesting look at behavioral economics and how people have managed to change the lives of millions of people significantly, but in these ways that you wouldn't expect, right? So when we think, okay, let's get people to recycle. Oh, let's put out recycling campaigns and make people think it's cool to recycle. No. Actually, if you just move a recycling bin 5 inches, so when someone, tries to throw something away, it's harder to throw stuff into a garbage can or whatever. Like, it's sort of about changing defaults and making it easier for people to make the best decisions.
And
I found that useful.
And that really comes back to, what we were talking about earlier and why it's important to have a very clearly defined objective function. Because if your objective function is just to influence a really large amount of people in a positive way, well, would being the person who makes the change of a recycling bin 5 feet away and actually does influence, millions or billions of people in a positive way, but nobody remembers you and it wasn't like a concept or a meme that you were sharing, yeah, would you still achieve your objective function or would you not achieve your objective function? And knowing that, maybe I could achieve my objective function in this other way, can help you determine what path you take next.
And the third book I'd recommend is Policy Paradox by Deborah Stone. I think this is a really useful book from the perspective of objective functions and how to best execute on them, because it looks at basically the paradoxes behind how to actually achieve that. For example, she's this beautiful part in the book where she describes the paradox that many governments face with the challenge of making policy that is quote unquote fair, because there are many, many different ways to define the word fair. You know, fair based on opportunity, fair based on just statistical chance, fairness based on merit and effort, fairness based on disadvantages, fairness based on who arrived first. I mean, you can just keep going. I think it's a really useful book when it comes down to actually thinking about how to best execute on what it is that matters to you.
We used an analogy from that book in our book that I really liked, the teacher having to divide a cake in class fairly. And it's, okay, how does she divide it? Does she divide it into equal slices? Yeah. Do people who come from disadvantaged backgrounds get bigger slices? Do hungrier people get bigger slices? Do the poorer students get bigger slices? Do the nicer students get bigger slices? What does fair mean? And I found that a really interesting thing, you know, within the context of society, because everyone always thinks that fair means whatever would benefit them the most, typically. Yeah.
Well, and a big takeaway from the book is that so much of what we do in life, and this is not just in policy or politics or business or anything, it comes down to how we define certain words and where we draw certain boundaries. And books like that are really helpful in enabling you to be effective. I think a lot of us are making a lot of like random moves without actually realizing
sort of running on autopilot.
Yeah, and we're not thinking about the fundamentals behind what we're doing. And those books are very helpful on that front.
Thank you for those great book recommendations. Anyone who's interested in checking out those books and the show notes, those will be at markberdy.com/E143. And one of the great ways to read books is to actually listen to audiobooks. And you can get a free month of Audible over at markberdy.com/audible. That will also be in the show notes. And one of the things that I find really interesting about your book is that you're able to get people to think really critically and get people to formulate these answers and get them to think on a higher level. But with the idea of answering questions in mind, I am going to flip the tables a little bit before we reach the conclusion of this episode. So I've asked the two of you several questions throughout our time together, and you help people find answers to their questions. But what do you two believe are, for each of you, one question that we need to be asking ourselves more often?
How am I holding myself back right now?
Oh, I would say, how am I wrong about this? Mm. You know, one thing that we really push for, and the nonprofit foundation that owns the book and the money from the book goes to, is really focused on this. It's to get people to spend more time focused on how they might be wrong and learn how to change their mind when they are wrong by their own established standards of evidence, and less time focused on how other people are wrong. And I think one of the things that is a real red flag that you need to pay attention to what someone else is saying is if it offends you. If what someone is saying offends you, it typically means one of two things. Either it's challenging your self-image slash your role within a certain social community or social hierarchy, or it is viably challenging some aspect of your worldview. And it's the second one where it's really important to say, this offends me. And the offense is sort of our brain's way of shutting down an idea before we really consider it. I need to mentally engage with this. I need to look and search as to why this separate person believes something different from me. And when we engage with that, we are more likely to realize that ideas that are very different from our own ideas often hold more value than we think they did. And we had been very good at ignoring them because they were offensive to us.
I like that. Yeah.
Well, thank you for providing those great questions. That's a lot of food for thought as we do come to the conclusion of the episode. And for anyone who wants to keep in tabs with Simone and Malcolm, don't forget to get your copy of The Pragmatist's Guide to Life. That book is on Amazon and will also be in the show notes. And if you're interested in a travel company that offers white glove concierge travel services without any fees, go to travelmax.com. They do comparison shopping, best prices, and find better prices and online shopping prices when you are on vacation. So I want to, again, thank the two of you for sharing all of your great insights on the show. It was a pleasure to have both of you on today.
Mark, we're honored. Thank you so much.
How does over 100 retweets per day sound to you? My free ebook, 27 Ways to Get More Retweets on Twitter, has you covered. I use the methods within this ebook to get over 10,000 retweets every single quarter. To learn more and get access to this free resource, visit markgaberti.com/retweet.